science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Zakowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker, from social media. They're the Twitter science dogs. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we take a deep dive into a timely science article and look at the research that's going on with our pets. In our Ask an Expert section, we have guests that will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. I hope you're happy and healthy out there. Another week, another podcast episode. Nothing very much to say right now at the start of the podcast. I'll leave some of the fun stories for later because there are some really fun dog stories. I took some time the last couple days to get started on a really nerdy project. It's a good stress reliever for me. I build these costume things. If you've seen the Disney's Mandalorian, oh, it's an amazing TV show. Love Disney's Mandalorian. I fell in love with the character, the Mando character, and many of the other characters on the show. So since the summer, I've been slowly picking away at building a family cosplay set, and I just started the IG-11 assassin droid. This is going to make no sense to people who haven't seen the show. Anyways, I finished the helmet, and it fits Adam perfectly. I posted it on social media. It's really cool. I can't wait for the whole set to come together. On the podcast this week in science news, we're going to take a look at a cool little device that may be able to charge batteries from waste heat in our house. In Pet Science, the article is all about pets and oxytocin. It's kind of cool, actually. Our guest and Ask an Expert is astrophysicist and folklorist Moya McTeer. What a crazy mix of education and storytelling. It's so cool. Hey dogs, why can't Cinderella play soccer? Because she's always running away from the ball. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at a really cool theoretical, quote unquote, prototype device that is basically an energy scavenger that could be placed all around your house. If you think about this question, what is the biggest cause of wasted energy in our daily lives? It's heat. Everything that uses electricity gives off a certain amount of heat that for the most part goes unused. These are big appliances like our refrigerator to light bulbs that hang in our ceiling. All of these give off unusable energy until maybe now and in the near future. Now, there are many places around the world and different devices that do make use of waste energy. Automobiles use waste energy and big power plants use waste energy, and that's converted into electricity. But the amount of heat that, say, your refrigerator gives off is so low level, it's just too low grade for any of our current technology to actually make use of it. What converts heat into electricity? How does that even happen? We have actually known about this phenomenon in science for hundreds of years. There are different materials that as you heat up one end and cool the other, electrons flow. Modern devices have semiconductors that are crazy small, really, really small. Think the size of a computer chip. And these are called thermoelectric materials. Well, one side of the chip heats up, the electrons move from it to the cold side. Basically, it's pretty technical, but the long and short of it is the electrons are being diffused like a hot gas. If you think about a gas that you could see with your eyes, a colored gas, if you heat up a flask, the gas particles will have more energy. There's a greater likelihood of them bonking into each other. And because there's a greater likelihood of them bonking into each other, they will slowly use that bonking energy and spread out. And that's sort of what's happening with electrons. All of our materials have to have a hot end and a cold end. And the cold end either has to be cooled or have materials that dissipate heat. So you constantly want this difference in temperature. Now, the devices that exist are actually really expensive. They work. They're really expensive. And they work really well when the hot and cold sides have a very big difference in temperature, like hundreds of degrees Celsius. And if you think about how hot your fridge gets or your laptop or even a light bulb, it's going to be really tough to have that huge temperature difference. So how and why are we talking about this? Did somebody overcome this issue? And the answer is, well, yes, in a prototype stage, they did. Materials physicist John Zhu and his colleagues at the Huizong University of Science and Technology didn't use electrons and they didn't use a gas. They used liquids. And the liquid thermocells absorb heat and move molecules, not electrons. So these thermocells are really good at converting tiny temperature differences. This is relative, so small temperature differences into electricity. And they only make very small currents. A lot of the reasons why they make small currents has to do with the fact that ions are slower to move than electrons. Ions can only carry heat through the material. That means you have to reduce the temperature difference. So your efficiency goes down. The paper gets into some pretty amazingly cool chemistry technical details. I'm going to try my best just to talk about the substance inside and how it works without going too crazy. So basically, they needed about a 50% temperature difference in lab to get this to work at the highest rate. That's a few products in your house might be able to get up to 50 degrees temperature difference, but not a lot. So they're aiming at about 50%. This still works under 50% difference. So they used a special type of ion goo called ferry cyanide. And on a hot electrode, it gives up an electron, changing from -4 to -3. Like electrons are negative, right? So if you lose an electron, you become more positive. That electron is what travels through the circuit. So the ion gives away its electron. Once the electron reaches the cold side, the electrons combine with the ions that had lost their electron and reforms the ferry cyanide ion. So how do you keep a system cool though, right? Like how do they have one hot side and one cool side? So there's a really ingenious method they did. They put a second compound in that causes crystallization to occur on the cold end. And if you have a solid, heat particles don't travel as easily through a solid. And because solids have more insulating ability, the solid that kind of goos up on the far side of the system stops heat being transferred from the hot end to the cold end. It keeps the cold side colder because you have this kind of blockage of precipitation, like liquid becoming a solid. It's super smart. This thermocell generated 5 times more power than any of the other electrodes that the team had developed. And they theorized that if you had, for example, a battery pack about the size of a paperback book, so there you could fit about 20 cells in there, you would be able to slurp up enough heat difference to power things like a mobile phone or a fan. So now you're really getting somewhere. Of course, you'd need somewhere to put this battery pack, but this is energy nobody is even using, right? This is energy that's just like bleh, going out into your house. That's why I found this article really, really interesting. Now, this is only going to get better as they keep perfecting it. And maybe you won't be able to power a cell phone from, say, a refrigerator if you don't have that 50 degree difference. But there's things in your house that do get up really, really hot that energy isn't converted into anything we can use. Now, I'll just give you a little bit of a warning. This isn't in the study, but Canadians actually found a problem with the high energy light bulbs. Everybody's listening to the podcast knows that I live in Alberta, Canada, and our winters are very long and they can get very, very cold. And I'm all for saving energy. But there was an inadvertent problem that occurred when Canadians started to switch to LED light bulbs from incandescent. And that was that our heating bills went way up. And nobody could figure out why the heating bills of a house went way up. We heat our house with natural gas. And it was because all of the light bulbs in a house were wasting so much electricity that wasted electricity was being converted to heat and actually doing a good job keeping the house warm. If you've ever used an Easy Bake Oven, the thing that cooks in the Easy Bake Oven is a light. Lights do get really hot, especially incandescent. Now, I don't know if it was an equal amount of money, like you save money on power because LEDs use so much less power and you had to pay for more natural gas. But for some people, their bill actually went up. They had to pay more to heat their house than they did in saving electricity on their light bulbs. So that was a little bit of an inadvertent thing. I don't think that's going to happen with this because there's a lot of things in your house that get hot. Man, like my wife's laptop I use to cut the podcast together, it gets so hot. Like it'll burn your skin if you leave it on your skin for too long. So this is just so cool. That's science news for this week. This week in pet science, it's all about the love hormone, oxytocin. And love, quote unquote, love as in non-romantical love. So this study comes to us from Japan, and the whole thing was revolving around, do dogs have similar responses to oxytocin as humans do? Just a little bit of background about oxytocin. It's produced in our pituitary glands. It's a little tiny thing inside our brain, doing things during moments like snuggling or cuddling or I guess some hanky-panky stuff, but it's associated between, the drug is associated in humans between the connections between spouses or between parents and their children. This study from Japan shows that oxytocin has an effect between non-romantical relationships between different species, if you can even believe it. So this study took 16 dogs and had them interact with their owners without any interference, just to jot down some notes, how they played, how they had fun. Then half of the group got a shot of nasal oxytocin, not the people, the dogs, and the other dogs got just saline, so nothing. So that was their control. And after the shot of oxytocin and after the shot of saline, they were allowed to see their owners again. It was overwhelming. The dogs that had the oxytocin were way more interested in interacting with their humans affectionately, like licking their faces or pawing at them or wanting hugs or snuggles or rubs. And the dogs that got nothing were pretty much exactly as they were before. A couple other interesting behaviors were noted. And the dogs that got the nasal oxytocin, they were sitting in a much closer proximity to their owner and locking eye contact for a lot longer. That was another behavior that the researchers noted. Now, more research has to be done as to why oxytocin would do this to dogs. It's kind of unclear. The prevailing idea is that it increased the animal's heart rate as it traveled to the brain and then caused further release of more natural oxytocin. Studies with humans have already shown a connection between more affection and oxytocin. So the conclusion is that oxytocin seems to be a hormone that is needed to maintain close bonds with dogs, humans, and even cats, because there's some studies that have shown the same thing in cats, or really any mammal species. The oxytocin system in our brains and other animal brains is really, really old. It's deep within our evolution. And therefore, it would probably have similar results among all of the different animal species. This oxytocin hormone link is another piece of the puzzle why humans and their dogs have such a tight relationship. An older study showed that when owners played with their dogs, the owners received a burst of natural oxytocin. And that's the same. If you think about your dog, if you have a dog or you've seen videos of Bunsen and Beaker, especially Beaker because she's a puppy right now and super playful. Man, did we grow attached to that little dog so fast? She was so fun. She still is fun. Bunsen's still fun. You know what I mean? But I think it's a sneaky way how puppies and even babies and kids get you attached to them so quickly. And speaking of babies and humans, a study in 2012 showed that fathers that got a little bit of oxytocin boost through their nose spent dramatically more times playing with their babies than fathers who didn't get the spritz. Now, I'm not saying you need to have an oxytocin spritz to be a good father or a good pet owner. It's just the science that goes into the connection and that hormone. It isn't all fun and games, though, for oxytocin. Oxytocin isn't without drawbacks. Other research has shown that people with elevated levels of oxytocin makes them more likely to reject people not of their group, people they see as outsiders. It can make people suspicious. Whether or not in antisocial behavior or suspicious behavior in cats and dogs, there is some overabundance of oxytocin. That's another thing the researchers would love to study. So if you've ever been playing with your dog, or you've had just such a fun time with your dog that day, and you felt like an over-the-top closeness with them, it's probably oxytocin to blame. That's Pet Science for this week. If you've been listening to the show and you like the content, consider signing up on our Patreon page as a patron. The podcast, unfortunately, isn't free to run, even though we really enjoy doing it. It's been a great addition to our lives to share more in-depth science news than our Twitter accounts and definitely Instagram can allow. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/BunsenBurner, and there are four tiers of support. If you head over there, you can see the different monetary amounts, but the lowest one is only $5 a month. That's not that bad. We do about 4 or 5 shows a month. 4 shows, great education and entertainment for $5. Can't beat it. Plus, we send out perks. The other way the show makes money is through merchandise sales. We've worked with a cartoonist to deliver some amazingly adorable merchandise on our merchandise shop, and that's at www.BunsenBurnerBMD.com. The links are in the show notes, and you can peruse the adorable merchandise. Thanks, guys. Now on to the interview. On the Science Podcast, in the Ask an Expert section, I'm excited to have Moya McTeer with me today, who is an astrophysicist and folklorist. An amazing combination. How are you doing today, Moya?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jason?
I'm good. We just got back from taking our dogs to the vet. No big deal or anything, but the little one, the little puppy, needed her second round of shots, and she got her microchip. So, yeah, and she was a trooper. She didn't even get bothered by it. It was the big guy that was the scaredy cat. So
it always is.
Yeah. Where are you calling into the podcast from in the world, Moya?
Right now, I'm up in Maine. I'm usually based in New York, but I came up to coastal Maine so that I could, you know, not deal with the pandemic in New York City.
Okay. Did you have the option to do that because you're like teleworking or you're working from home?
Yeah, I'm really lucky in that I am doing research full time. I'm a PhD student at Columbia right now, and I'm done taking classes. So I'm just doing research full time, and all of my research is done on a computer, so I can do it from anywhere.
So New York was hit really hard, so I can see maybe why you wanted to get out of Dodge there. At least.
Yeah. Also, I live in a one bedroom apartment in Manhattan with a partner and a cat. And that's just not enough space for three bodies to exist in 24/7.
to be on shelter in place. Hey.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you got some more space where you're at. One of the other question we always ask guests kind of right up the top is, you mentioned you're a PhD student. And we love to know about our guests' educational experience. Like, your training is in astrophysics, but what was your journey in education to this point?
I went to high school at this public, very rural school in Pennsylvania called West Green. And it was a really small school. I actually graduated in a class of 55 people. Just so small. Everyone knew everyone's business. which I guess that's like most high schools, right? But from there, I worked really hard and I was really lucky, and I went to Harvard for undergrad. I had no idea what I wanted to study at first, but we have to declare a major in the end of sophomore year, or like the end of the first semester of sophomore year. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. But one of my friends dragged me to an introductory astronomy course, and the professor said she'd give us free pizza every week. So I signed up. And that same
semester, so it was pizza that started this. Is that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I'm sorry I interrupted you. That's just adorable.
Yeah. I like to say that I'm an astronomer because I followed my stomach, and I love carbs, really. And that same semester, I lived across the street from the Folklore and Mythology building, and they had open houses with tea and cake. So I went there, and I decided I didn't want to have to choose between either of them. So I studied both. And now it's 6 years later, and I'm still doing both, which feels really great. I graduated from Harvard in 2016 and immediately started a PhD program at Columbia, and I am wrapping up now. I'm in my last year.
Oh, well, congratulations. That's a very difficult road, and you're kind of, you're in the last few clicks of it, or the miles, I guess.
Yeah, I have been in school for 20 years. It's a long time. I'm glad to be done soon.
your graduating class was really small. That's something I can relate to. I grew up in rural Alberta, Canada, and my grad class, I think, had even less than that. It was a little teeny tiny town. So yes, when you know everybody, when your grad class is that small, as you said, everybody knows everybody's business. So you're right. you must have pursued some kind of science to go from high school to your undergrad. Was there a draw to that for you in high school, or were you kind of looking for a path and you kind of just were led that way by happenstance?
Somewhere in between. So I was annoyingly good at everything in high school. reality hit me hard when I got to college and I realized I was no longer like the biggest fish in the pond. But I was good at everything in high school, so I didn't know what I wanted to study. I bounced around thinking maybe I want to become a lawyer or go into politics. Maybe I want to be a writer or a filmmaker. And my mom always wanted me to be a scientist. When I was growing up, she was an adjunct professor at a local college. I actually make more money now as a graduate student than my mom did when I was growing up, and she just didn't want that life for me. So she was always pushing me to be a scientist. And when I got to college, she really encouraged me to pursue those, but I just couldn't find something that fit until sophomore year when I was offered that pizza. And that was enough of a fit for me.
Pizza initially got you there, but what was the draw to space after that point?
Yeah, looking back, I can actually remember the exact class and what we were learning the day that I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. And we were learning about the expansion of the universe and how the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate. And I remember that before it had always been explained to me either in math or just in words, like I just said. But for the first time ever in that class, the professor had us do a demonstration, and like an interactive demonstration with our bodies, where he had us line up. He picked like five students and had us line up in front of the classroom. And the floor of, this is important, the floor of the classroom was lined in those like square foot tiles.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so he had everyone stand with two tiles between us. And then he had the people on the outskirts move so that there were now four tiles between you and the next person. And the person in the middle could see that, like, everyone on the ends appeared to be moving faster than the people right next to them, even though to the people on the ends, they weren't moving at a faster rate. If that makes any sense. It's much easier to do like in person with your body. And it was just so cool to me that you could explain this really difficult concept in that really simple way, just by having people move to different squares on the floor. And I thought to myself, if this is how astronomers explain things, and if this is the type of reaction that you can get from people by explaining this stuff, like, that's what I want to do. That seems so cool.
So it was almost like you found some a calling to teach, almost like to that, like not necessarily to teach, but to explain. And it was the wonder and the excitement that came from it.
Yeah, I guess since the beginning of my astronomy career, I've been really passionate about teaching it and communicating science. So One of my favorite things about astronomy is that it's something that pretty much everyone in the world can relate to, and it can be used to connect pretty much everyone in the world. So I like to think of astronomy as a gateway science. Like, if you can get people interested in astronomy, then you can get them interested in other sciences too.
Start big and then go small, because everybody can look up. Everybody can look up to the sky.
Yeah.
Very cool. You're working on some research. Can you tell everybody some about your research, or is it a little bit hush-hush?
It's not hush-hush. I'm very open about it.
Okay. I'd love to hear.
Yeah. I study broadly planets outside of our solar system. Those are called exoplanets, and how they're affected by the motion of the Milky Way galaxy. Some people might call what I do a search for the galactic habitable zone. So the galactic habitable zone would be a place or places in the galaxy where habitable planets are most likely to form.
Okay. Is that, I've heard that referred to as the Goldilocks zone. Is that kind of the same idea, or is it out of favor to call it that?
No, that's absolutely right. So, most people, if they've heard the term Goldilocks zone, probably would have heard it in the context of stellar systems. The idea that there's a place around a star where the temperature is just right for liquid water. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. So it's the Goldilocks zone. The same idea applies on a bigger galactic scale, except when we're talking about galactic habitability, we're not just talking about temperature. In the past, people have tried to study galactic habitability by looking at supernova rates. If you're anywhere near a supernova, then it's probably going to destroy the chance for life on your planet. People have looked at the trends of chemical elements as you go to different parts of the galaxy. I look at the way that the galaxy moves. So a good example of this is my latest project, where I looked at the center of the galaxy and tried to figure out how common close stellar encounters are. So not stellar collisions, those are extremely rare, but just close flybys. If a star flies by another star and one of them has planets around it, what would that mean for the systems?
What would that mean for the systems?
Oh, okay. Great question, maybe, Jason.
I'm sorry. You're probably just figuring out what that means, but I'm just like, I'm so puzzled by that. Wouldn't it would mess up the planets, wouldn't it, potentially?
Yeah. And it depends on so many different things. It depends on how far away the encounter is, what the masses of the stars are, and so many different factors. But generally, a really bad consequence would be a planet getting ripped away from its host star. That would be really bad. Another really bad consequence would be maybe immediately after the encounter, the planet isn't ripped away from its host star, but its orbit becomes unstable, so that over time, the planet, maybe like a million years later, the planet gets flung out of its system. A less terrible consequence would be if a star passes by a system of planets and it perturbs something that's very similar to our Oort cloud. So the Oort cloud is this big cloud of asteroids and comets that exist far, far away from the sun, but still held in place by the sun's gravity. If a star passed through something like an Oort cloud, it could throw some of those comets and asteroids in towards the planets. And so then you would get a lot of these really bad collisions, like what killed the non-avian dinosaurs on our own planet. So like, bad things happen when close stellar encounters happen.
Yeah, that was a rough go for the dinosaurs. I mean, they weren't far along enough to have some kind of like asteroid detection, NASA right. type thing. And they're like,
True.
Okay, now people who maybe like myself, I like to think about it kind of from like a crazy doomsday scenario, because I watch those cheesy Bruce Willis Armageddon type stuff. Some people are probably wondering too, is our star at risk of any of this, or are we fairly safe?
We're pretty safe. I like to describe our region of the galaxy as like the suburbs of the Milky Way. We're not very close to any stars. The nearest star is 4 light years from us, more than 4 light years. So we're pretty spread apart. We're not really close to any stars that are in danger of going supernova in our species' lifetime. And we're not any we're not like in a spiral arm. So spiral arms are really dense and have a lot of radiation. So we're not in one of those. So our part of the galaxy is pretty tame. Some might even say boring compared to other parts of the galaxy.
It's probably now difficult for us to explore stars because we're so far away from like a cluster. That's another one of the things that I thought I read, is that maybe if we were in an arm, it might be more dangerous, but we mm-hmm. could have a star much closer to get some kind of like probe to.
Yeah, that would definitely be great. Although if I had to choose one, like if I had to choose like getting a lot of information about a star or being able to live, like I would choose living.
It's better to be boring than exciting and flung out into the deepness of space, I guess. Hey?
Exactly. That's my philosophy on life anyway.
Yeah. Do you do any of that kind of like thinking, like what would happen if Earth got like blasted out of its orbit and how long things would survive on Earth? Or is that, or am I just in a crazy kind of fantasy scenario in my own head?
No, I do a similar kind of thinking. So instead of thinking what would happen if Earth, as we know it, suddenly got blasted out of our solar system, I do a lot of thought exercises about what would a whole species be like if it evolved on a planet that previously was blasted out of its solar system. What would that mean for life and culture on that planet? That's one of the ways that I bring my folklore background into my astronomy and science communication work. That's what I do in my podcast called Exolore.
Oh, this is such a great segue. Thank you. I was trying to think of a great segue to get to your amazing podcast, but this works. This is great. You have this really cool podcast called Exolore, and you kind of preface what it was about. Can you tell everybody a little bit more about it and maybe where you got the idea to start it from?
Absolutely. So Exolore, the name itself, is a portmanteau of two words, exo from exoplanet and lore from folklore. So I'm really mashing together my two areas of expertise. The podcast itself is about facts-based fictional world building. And in every episode, I invite expert guests. Notice I say expert and not scientist, because I don't want it to just be scientists all the time. I invite expert guests to help me imagine what life might be like on different alien planets. I really came up with it in college, like at its most fundamental form, when I was putting together my senior thesis, which was a science fiction novel set on a real exoplanet that I studied. And I wanted to make sure that the biology and the culture of the life forms on that planet, like the characters in the story, I wanted to make sure that it was influenced by the science and by the research that I did. That's how Exolore came to be. And over time, it shifted from my senior thesis project to workshops that I've taken around the world, actually, to teach people how science can inspire creativity. It had a very brief career as a live show in New York City, and now it's a podcast.
That's so cool. I've listened to a couple episodes. It's fascinating for people who like, it's so good. For people who love like fantasy mixed with sci-fi, but like real good sci-fi. We've talked about this before on the podcast, how you can have like sci-fi that would never ever happen and it's magic, like Star Wars, which is good. Mm-hmm. I mean, Star Wars is cool. And then you can have science fiction that is grounded in some kind of reality with rules that we could understand, like The Expanse on Amazon, right? And that's what I thought was really cool. And
well, I had a planet that was smaller than Earth.
The opposite. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No. You were right. It was smaller, and so gravity was stronger, just because when you were on the surface of this planet, you were closer to the center of mass. So the force of gravity on you was stronger than it is here on Earth.
Okay, that's the one I did listen to. Yeah, that's crazy, and how that would be so different for anything that lived there. And just the thinking of that is really cool. It's I don't know. I enjoy The Expanse because it talked about, I don't know if you've seen The Expanse from Amazon.
A few episodes.
Yeah. It's got some stuff that's probably, you know, magic-y magic, but the people that live out in zero gravity have elongated bodies and things like that because there's no gravity. So they try at least to explain some of the biology. From just to give people a little bit of Cole's notes, what are some things from that episode of having a smaller planet with higher levels of gravity? What would that change?
So one big thing that it changes is that the land masses are closer together. Because if the planet's smaller, then it just doesn't have as much surface area. So the continents are closer together. And the cool thing about this podcast is that the conversation is really shaped so much by who the guests are and like the direction they want to take it. And honestly, for that episode, they took it in a direction that I did not expect. Because I always go in with an idea of what we might end up creating, like what type of life form, and they just knocked it out of the park. Really, we ended up with two kind of dominant species, one on land and one in the sea. And the land species, without giving too much away, ended up being sentient mushrooms, which was really fun.
I was trying to remember that was some kind of it was a I thought it was a plant or something. I was trying to remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you planning to continue Exolore for the near future? Like, is it something you're going to it's going to be ongoing for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I really enjoy making it. And I think that there are so many different things that people can get from the episodes, but also just world building as an exercise. I think that world building is really beautiful as a process because it's inherently introspective and reflective. In order to build and imagine another world, you have to be really in tune with how your own world works. And so I always find world building to be incredibly cathartic as an exercise. And so I want to give that to other people, but also it's just like really fun. So yeah, you can rest assured that Exolore will continue. For the first time in the future.
I love the idea so much. There's a really popular video game that I played the heck out of called Mass Effect, and it had different planets and different life forms on that. And it's sort of similar to your idea, as they had to build the story around that different planet's characteristics and the civilizations that would live there based on, you know, what based on science. And that's my favorite part. I would spend hours reading the little text that whoever wrote about the different things. That's so cool. Well, thanks for sharing your podcast. We'll have a link to Moya's podcast in the show notes. You're like one click away from listening to another really great podcast.
Yeah, I hope you enjoy it.
Yay. One of the things we ask our guests kind of in the middle of the interview is for a pet story. Do you have a pet story you could share with us? This we mix science and animals here. So just like Moya mixes astrophysics and folklore, it's kind of an interesting mix. Do you have a pet story you could share with us?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I have an adorable cat. His name is Cosmo, with a K, not with a C. So it's not as appropriate as you might think it is. But Cosmo, I like to call him a foister cat. Because my mom foisted this cat upon me. My partner and I are both allergic to cats, but she couldn't take care of this cat anymore. So she gave him to us. And now he is just like the best cat I have ever met. Recently, since my partner and I have been working from home and we're just constantly with Cosmo, he's gotten really affectionate in a way that I've never seen a cat be affectionate before. So every morning, about 3 hours before I wake up, Cosmo will jump onto the bed and he'll give this really loud meow, like a meow. And then he will like nuzzle himself under the covers and like spoon me. My cat spoons me every morning, and he'll lay like that, fall asleep for 3 hours until we wake up. And it's just the most adorable thing I've ever seen. Have you ever heard of a cat doing this?
We don't have cats, but they are they are interesting creatures. They are.
Yeah. Well, I'm really happy. I think I really lucked out with Cosmo. I said that my partner and I are both allergic. The really amazing thing is that about a month and a half after we got him, we both stopped being allergic.
Oh, wow. That's lucky.
Yeah. And it's not just with Cosmo. I think our immune systems just kind of gave up and they were like, okay, we can handle cats now if you insist on having one around. But the really amazing thing is that it's not just Cosmo that we got used to. My partner's dad has two cats, and now we can go over to his apartment and be fine with his two cats. Whereas before, we used to have to take Benadryl every time we visited. So that's great. Oh,
I know all about that. I am allergic to cats. Maybe I shouldn't let my wife listen to this podcast because that's why we don't have cats and we have dogs instead, because I'm really allergic to them. But maybe you just have to force yourself to be quarantined with a cat for a month, and that just fixes all allergies. There's got to be some science there.
There's definitely some science in exposure therapy to allergies. I don't know the science well, but like I've heard tell of such science.
Yeah. We talked about it on the podcast with kids, that if you're little, like little children who are exposed to more pets and dirt and stuff like that, they have way less allergies as they age. So, cool. there is some, and I'm not a researcher, but I just am a science communicator. So, but I remember that's a little tidbit that we shared on the podcast a while back. How long have you had Cosmo? I apologize if I missed that.
No, I didn't say it. We got him in August of 2019. He was only a few months old when we got him. So he's young and spry and really energetic.
Oh, little kittens are adorable. Was he a playful one or a sleepy one?
He's really playful.
Aw.
Yeah, my partner had never had a cat before, and so he would wrestle with Cosmo like he was a dog. And I think doing it when he was really young and like didn't totally know how to use his like claws and teeth yet and just wasn't very strong or fast, I think that helped him become like the best version of a playful cat that he could be. And that's what we have now.
So does he bite with belly rubs? And if he bites, it's not as bad as normal cats. That's the thing Oh, he does? Yeah. You never know how many belly rubs you can belly rub a cat before they'll take your hand. Like that.
Exactly. But he's really great at batting your hand away without claws. Like he'll get really aggressive, just like hitting you, but he won't use his claws unless he is like two in the moment and isn't really thinking. And I've never seen a cat be that careful about keeping his claws retracted. So I think I'm really lucky.
That is adorable, because it just feels like you're getting hit by a little pillow.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Like the little little paw, it's not sharp. Yeah. It's kind of like our Bernice Mountain Dog's paw.
Like a little bean.
Yeah. Oh. Our Bernice Mountain Dog's paw is huge, right? He's a great big dog. But when we keep his nails pretty trim, but his paw is like this great big gushy thing. So if he ever hits you, it feels like you got smacked by a fuzzy punching glove. Like it's just like, he's big enough. It can hurt, but it's always soft. Mm-hmm. So you're like, oh, you can't get too mad at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing your story about Cosmo. That's great.
I'm glad the universe can know about Cosmo.
We've had so many guests lately share about cats. So that they seem to be the more popular pet lately. So that's kind of interesting.
What's the least typical pet story you've had on the show? Like anyone with a bearded dragon or something?
No, we've had people who have lizards and snakes, gerbils, and probably the most unique one was Dr. Kristen Lear, who studies bats. She talked about having rats. She has pet rats and she loves them. Yeah, because she trained them to be like, they're actually quite trainable. I learned a lot from her talking about her pet rat. So that was definitely unique. I mean, as somebody who from New York, you have probably seen rats in a much different light. Not to be too stereotypical, but they are
rats carrying whole pizza slices.
We saw that. The kids forwarded that me for, because I teach high school chemistry. That was actually, they were sending me like memes of the pizza rat. The other question we always ask guests is for the super fact. And the super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of like blows their mind a bit. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I feel like all astronomy facts are super facts.
This is true.
Yeah. But I know I'm biased. in that. One thing that I think really blows people's minds is that astronomers have learned that what we can see and feel, like all of the matter that we can actually see, only makes up about 5% of the universe. And the vast majority of the universe, about 70%, is dark energy, which we don't understand at all. We have no idea what dark energy is or how it works. We think that it's the force that's responsible for the accelerated expansion of the universe. And then the other 25% is dark matter. And we know more about dark matter. We understand how it works. We've figured out how to at least like identify it out in space, but we don't know what it's made of. So we don't understand 95% of the universe, which is just like wild to me and kind of embarrassing, actually, that we know so little.
So, yeah, because you look at physics and you're like, hey, physics, what's going on in outer space? And physics is like, oh, and they just like shrugs. But does that fill you with, like, you study this for your life. This must fill you with wonder, right? Like, I just have such envy for people in a field like that, where you are solving these questions which have yet to be answered.
Yeah, that part is really cool. One of my favorite parts of doing research is that moment where you like press the enter key on your keyboard to run a code or a piece of script, and you get a result. And you, like, I know for a fact that no one has ever like looked at this data in exactly this way to get this result before. And that feels really great to know that I'm contributing to human knowledge and this like great human endeavor of learning about the universe. That feels awesome. But I do think that being a professional astronomer has kind of desensitized me in a way to the wonders of space. Maybe part of that is because I didn't grow up stargazing and looking up at the night sky. I found astronomy in college because of pizza, right? So to me, astronomy isn't a beautiful image of a night sky. It's a series of numbers and vectors and matrices that I can manipulate and run calculations on a computer. So that just, like, I'm not as awed by space as I wish I were, if that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense. One of the things I always mention is it's interesting how, like, because I teach high school kids, right? And I've said this before on the podcast. We do have a small part of our curriculum in grade 9 where the kids learn about space. And sadly, space goes away. Like, it doesn't come back in high school unless kids take high levels of physics to learn about planet rotations and gravity. But some of the kids have never had to think about space before they get a teacher in grade 9. And we do a really good job at our school. And for some of the kids, it grabs them. And I think for some of the kids, it's just too big and too crazy for them to wrap their head around. So they're just like, nope, too big. I don't want to deal. You just showed me a star that like 1,000 of our stars could fit inside. No, thank you.
Yeah. I have found that like when I talk about what I do, a lot of people get really intimidated by the sheer size of space and the universe. And I actually find it really comforting to know that I'm so small in the grand scheme of things, because it makes me feel, this is going to sound so cheesy, but it like honestly does make me feel closer to my fellow humans, because we are all so tiny and we are all that we have, right? Like, the universe is so huge, we mean nothing to the rest of it. So we should make sure that we mean everything to each other. And I'm comforted by space in that way.
Oh, I love that. That's such a great message from a humanity perspective. That's really profound. That the conversation we're having and people are having all around the world right now, as of yet, that's the only conversations we know that are ever happening anywhere.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I hope people like you and other astronomers and astrophysicists eventually find some kind of life-like thing out there that would be really cool. But one of the things that another astrophysicist said is that the only planet that we know that's like us is us. So yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
One more question, follow-up question before we go on to the next one is with dark energy and it's causing...
So if you look at what we know about the Big Bang and how it worked. So in the first like few minutes of the universe, it expanded so rapidly. Like it went from the size of maybe my fist to something that is big enough to host galaxies in the span of a few minutes. And that expansive force should continue. Like no one disagreed with that for a long time. But we thought that with gravity and all of the matter in the universe, that it should either be slowing down or just keeping on at a fixed rate. And the really weird thing that we found was that the expansion is getting faster. It's accelerating. And so there must be some force that's adding energy or like oomph to the system for the universe to be expanding at an accelerating rate. And dark energy is that oomph.
It's like if you shove somebody on a frictionless surface, they should just be like sliding away from you at whatever rate that you shove them. But it's like there's an invisible hand just making them go faster away from you. And that's the dark energy is this invisible hand that's like move. That is bizarre. That is crazy.
I know.
I love it.
I know, right? Also, I love that your example was like pushing someone on ice is like,
of course. Oh, yeah, that's very Canadian. That's very Canadian. Yeah. I was like, what's slippery? Well, you know, 10 months of the year, not that many months, but 8 months of the year, there's ice everywhere.
Love
that
it.
Doesn't make a sense to a lot of people in the southern parts of the United States. They're like, what's ice?
Right.
And comes from the fridge. Okay, well, that was an awesome super fact that led to a really cool discussion about dark energy. Thank you. I really enjoy the last question because the last question or the last area of the podcast, we let guests kind of lead it in some place that is not necessarily related to science. It could be a cause or something they're really passionate about. And you have a passion for tattoos. And this is so cool. What do you love about tattoos?
I love the ritual aspect of it. I love the self-identification aspect of it, that tattoos are a way of us putting our own decoration and like telling our own stories on our bodies for other people to see, or maybe for other people not to see, right? If they're in a hidden location. And I think it's so, the idea of me thinking like my body isn't finished, like I want to add something to it and then I can go and do that and it's part of my body forever. I think that that's just so beautiful. Also, I think it feels really good. I know that's weird, but like I love getting a tattoo.
And you have tattoos. Are you comfortable telling everybody about your tattoos?
Yeah, absolutely. I have 9 tattoos. So I'm not going to tell you about like each and every one because that would take too long.
Meet your favorite ones, or maybe they're all your favorite. Like that's a terrible question. I know. Sorry.
They're not all my favorite, but I do appreciate each and every one because I have a tendency to get tattoos at big moments in my life. And part of that might be a way of me like getting control back over my life, because I found that I tend to get tattoos when things are really hard. My dad was in a car accident last year and I got a tattoo that same day. To feel like I was controlling something. I guess my favorite tattoos, if I had to choose, my first tattoo ever is a tattoo of Orion on my chest, very close to my heart, literally. Orion.
Oh, that's so cool.
Getting this tattoo of Orion was my way of dedicating myself to astronomy, because I got it the like a month after I declared an astronomy major. And to me, it was also really important that it was a constellation, because it tied in the myth part of my major as well. So I will always love the Orion tattoo that I have. Another tattoo that I really love is a stack of turtles on my back, because of the saying, it's turtles all the way down, which has, like, you can apply it to so many different contexts. But when I learned it, I was in a folklore class and we were talking about the idea that when you're doing ethnography, when you're studying another culture, there's always more to learn. There are always more layers to peel back. And in that way, it's like turtles all the way down. Like you can never get to the end of the turtles. And so I got that tattoo. And I love when people, like, if I'm standing in line for something and someone behind me sees the tattoo and they're like, is that turtles all the way down? And I'm like, yes, you're one of my people. You understand. And I find that like tattoos can be really bonding in that way as well.
They can. I don't have a tattoo myself, but when I was younger, like say in high school and in college, I was a big video gamer with like Legend of Zelda. And I've seen lots of people with the Triforce from the game, like that's a symbol from this video game. And then I have to talk to the person who, if I see somebody with a Triforce tattoo, I'm like, that is amazing. Your tattoo is like a part of my heart. I just love it so much. So that must be so cool when people recognize the turtles all the way down, the infinite learning that you're never done uncovering secrets and knowledge of the world. That's so cool.
Just to like bond with someone over that.
Do you look at the other cultures' tattoos and study them too, or look at them with admiration?
I definitely admire other cultures' tattoos. I love that it's especially traditional tattoos, like when tattoos are really embedded in culture, that there are motifs and themes that you can see spread widely. I love hearing stories of people who have carried on traditional tattooing methods. There's a tattoo artist named Wang Odd in the Philippines who she's over 100 years old. And so she's been tattooing the same way for like 90 years because she learned it when she was young in an apprenticeship model. And I just love learning about that. But in college, I studied the tradition of American tattooing and how it has its roots in sailor culture and prison culture in the US. I spent a semester observing a tattoo artist in Boston. And like I spent my weekends for a semester with this artist and learned his rituals. Because what you'll see if you go to a bunch of different artists is that for the most part, like the whole process is the same, but individual artists will have tiny changes that are individual to them, like the order that they prepare, either like do they do the inks first or the tattoo gun first. Like it's just really fascinating to me to see how people make this process their own.
Oh wow, that it's almost like it's a, I'm trying to not really religious but spiritual almost. It can be religious, I guess, and the
for
tradition
sure.
of that.
Yeah.
That's very cool. I am not brave enough to get a tattoo. And maybe it's just because I haven't thought of something. I haven't thought of something that I connect with enough to put on my body. But I always, when I see people with tattoos, that's what I think is it's like, it's something that they connected with at that point in their life that they needed to be a part of themselves. I don't know if that's this, if I'm on the right track, but for somebody without a tattoo, that's what I think.
That definitely happens. But I think there are also people who get a tattoo because like it's pretty. Earlier this year, I got an impulse tattoo when I was at a conference in Hawaii, and my friend and I got matching wave tattoos. And it's not the most meaningful tattoo ever, but it was just this beautiful moment of like my friend and I were together and we see each other maybe once a year and we decided to celebrate that by getting a tattoo with each other. And so tattoos don't always have to be meaningful themselves. It can just be the experience that means a lot to the person.
That's cool. I'm so glad I talked to you about this because I've just learned so much in this last little bit because I know nothing about it. I'm not, if you don't know, if like none of my wife doesn't have a tattoo and my siblings don't either. So it's just an area that I have no knowledge about. Some tattoo artists are just, their artwork is insane and the skill level that they have it blows my mind how they can take something like that and put it on the body.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah. I can't even draw on a flat piece of paper.
Yeah. On the flip side though, I have seen some tattoos, which I think I'm like, I don't know, but I hope, you know, because the, hopefully the person that has that loves it.
Yeah. You get what you pay for with a tattoo.
As we do in life with everything, I think. Thanks for sharing your stories about tattoos. Hopefully I didn't butcher the questions too much, but it's such a cool little right-hand turn we went after talking about the space and folklore. did you ever think about getting a pizza tattoo instead of the Orion one?
Oh, great question. I haven't, but I'm thinking about it now.
No, I'm just teasing. I'm just teasing. Kind of come to the end of the interview, Moya. Where can people find you on social media and any accounts you'd like to plug that you have?
Great. Thanks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram, but like mostly Twitter, at Go Astro Mo. And you can find Exolore wherever you get your podcasts. And also in the link that Jason's going to put down below.
Yeah, you betcha. You're one click away from listening to some really good podcasts, sci-fi, folklore stuff, and from following Moya on Twitter. Is there any other accounts or causes you'd like to plug before we finish?
One last thing that I'd like to plug is the African American Women in Physics site, AAWIP.com. It's a site that is an amazing project, but it's really sad that it's possible to do it. It has kept track of all of the Black women in the U.S. who have advanced degrees in physics and physics-related fields. I am going to be the 23rd Black woman to get a PhD in astronomy in the U.S., which, like, there just should be way more of us. So I would love it if more people would spend some time on that website. I did a poll earlier today on Twitter to ask how many Black scientists with PhDs people could name. And I think like half of the people who responded said they could only name 0 to 3 Black scientists. So like, take some time, hopefully, to please learn about more Black scientists. That'd be great.
That's a great message. I will have that website link as well in the show notes.
Thank you.
Well, this was such a fun chat. It was really educational and inspirational and deep, actually. So thanks for joining us on the Science Podcast today.
Well, thanks so much for having me and listening to my stories about my cat.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10, that's BUNSEN 10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Sciences for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have another Thurber teacher with me. It's Corey Reynolds. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
That's great. Corey, you're new to Thurber this year.
Yeah, I moved from Edson, so a bit of an upgrade city-wise, but I'm enjoying my time here so far.
Oh, cool. What do you teach, Corey?
I'm teaching physics and some general sciences.
Right. And how is startup for you? Is it going okay?
Yeah, it's going good. Getting used to some of the different routines, but I'm enjoying myself.
Cool. And you are helping with cross-country running.
Yeah, I'm helping with cross-country running. So we're getting a chance to at least get the kids out there, even though meets are still up in the air.
But. Right. Yeah, all of that. I know I talked to the volleyball coaches, Jackie and Danielle, and they don't know what's happening with games, but kids are practicing, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it gets them to spend some time with their friends that they'd normally run with. So that's awesome to at least get them out there.
I think of all of the sports that is the safest for COVID, cross-country running where you're outside is probably the safest.
Yeah, they can spread out.
So yeah, maybe sure. Tennis, singles tennis or something like that, right? All right, so you ready for Woo or Wow?
Yeah, we'll give this a try.
Okay, so recap for Woo or Wow. I will read 3 statements. 2 of them are fake. They're woo. One of them is true. It's a wow. You have to find the true statement. And the category this week is tattoos.
Okay.
Moya McTeer, the astrophysicist on this week, her special segment, she talked about her love of tattoos. Do you have a tattoo, Corey?
I do, yes.
Oh, you do? I am too chicken to get a tattoo. Is it too personal to ask you what it is?
No, it's on my inside left ankle. It's a tattoo of my fraternity symbols.
Oh, that's so cool. That's awesome. I was talking to Moya about this. I just haven't connected with anything. Maybe like the Triforce from Legend of Zelda or something like that. The N7 Mass Effect symbol. Anyways, you ready to go?
Yep.
All right. First statement. The island and country of New Zealand has the highest number of citizens with tattoos. I would love to go to New Zealand. I haven't been there yet. It looks like a gorgeous place. Plus, they filmed Lord of the Rings there. So,
yeah, it would be really cool to go there.
Okay.
Want to hear the next one? Second statement?
Yes, please.
The second statement, the oldest known tattoo was found on human skin from the Crusades on a night dated from 1050 AD.
That's pretty old. Slightly older than I am, yeah.
Right. Third statement. More men than women in the world have tattoos. Is there a statement you're leaning towards as being false right off the top?
I'm leaning towards the 1050 AD statement being false.
Okay.
Right now.
Any idea why?
I think it's actually older than that.
Okay.
If I was going with my gut. But.
Okay. So that means we're down to more men than women have tattoos and New Zealand.
I'm going to lean towards New Zealand as being the one that's true.
The one that's being true?
Yeah.
And any idea why? Just your gut?
It's just a gut. I've never been to New Zealand, so this is just a gut feeling.
So final answer?
Final answer.
All right, so we've locked in. Let's take a look at the second statement. That's the one that you said was woo right off the bat. You're right. That is a incorrect statement. The oldest known tattoo is way older than that. It was actually found on the Iceman that they've pulled out of that bog. That is dated at 3,300 BC. So thousands of years. And of course, we know ancient Romans and Greeks probably had tattoos too.
Yeah.
And the Egyptians. All right, so that means we're down to two statements. Which one do you want to hear first? Do you want to hear the more men than women one, or do you want to hear the island country one?
Let's hear the men and women one.
Okay. More men than women in the world have tattoos is... Woo! You've won. You got
Sweet.
It.
Sweet.
Yeah. More women than men have tattoos. And the most common symbol is... Do you have any idea? A heart.
Oh, I was going to go butterfly.
Or a little angel. So you are correct. New Zealand has the highest percentage of citizens with tattoos. And it's because of the Maori with the Polynesian culture. They have the traditional Polynesian tattoos. Sometimes in those communities, 100% of adults have tattoos.
That's really cool to know. I did not know that.
I love their tattoos are so intricate, right? If you've seen The Rock, he's just covered with them, right? Maui from Moana. Have you seen Moana?
I haven't seen
Moana. You haven't seen Moana. Okay, so the people that have seen Moana know what I'm talking about. He's got the dancing tattoos on his back.
I have definitely seen The Rock. So
there you go. Well, congratulations. You've won. We're well. You're going to make Graham really salty.
That's my aim.
That's your aim? All right, take care.
Yeah, you have a good one.
Okay, it's time for the mailbag with me, Adam. And mailbag time. So, if you don't know what the mailbag is, we haven't done it in a little bit, but the mailbag is when we answer questions that you send in to us on Twitter or stuff like that. The first question is from Twitter. Do Beaker and Bunsen consume mass quantities of food? Mom, you can answer that one.
We feed the dogs a raw diet, and so I don't know if it's mass quantities of food, but what...
It's a lot.
But the benefits of doing so outweigh using kibble. So if we use kibble, they have massive poops.
Like Bunsen's poops are so big.
They're so massive. So with the raw, they're able to metabolize more of the food and their poops are smaller. What else? Why else do we use raw? Just for the nutritional and health benefits?
Bunsen pukes up kibble.
And Bunsen gets sick on kibble. He has a very sensitive stomach, so we have to be really aware of that. And when we first got Beaker, we fed her kibble. And when we went out to the coast, we had kibble. And because Beaker is a hungry, hungry hippo, she would gobble it down and then try and get Bunsen's. And he just was like choking on it, trying to choke it down to eat faster than her. And actually, we ran out of raw the other day, so I put actually way too much food in their dish. I actually put, like, their whole allotment, and that's what I fed them. And then Bunsen put his nose under, and he went, whoop, and then the food went everywhere, and it really was like a game of hungry, hungry hippos.
I think the kibble gave Beaker farts.
Yeah, it wasn't good. There was some crazy smells happening at our household.
So, yeah, Bunsen is like Ron Swanson. He doesn't like change. Well, that kind of leads into our next question. Does Bunsen ever resent Beaker? Resent a little bit, yeah. It depends on the situation. Because When Bunsen, like, has something, Beaker always wants to take it. She's like a two-year-old. Like, you know when you have a two-year-old and then that you have something and then they want it? And then as soon as you have – as soon as they have it, they don't want it anymore because you don't have it? That's Bunsen and Beaker, because Beaker is like a little two-year-old wanting everything that Bunsen has, and then as soon as she's done with it, she just stops, and then Bunsen grabs it again. It's just a big circle. But yes, Bunsen does get a little jealous when she takes stuff or when she gets more attention than him. So a little bit, yeah, Bunsen does resent Beaker a little bit sometimes.
I'd say most of the time they're good buds, though.
Oh, yeah. Almost all the time they're good buds. All right. The next question is, how did you become interested in science? I love your scientific knowledge. Now, this one is for my dad because, you know, I'll just let him answer the question.
Usually, this is the question I've asked guests on the podcast is why they got so interested in science. So I teach high school chemistry and I have a science degree and an education degree. And to try and pinpoint how I got so interested in science probably was three things. I was super, super interested in space when I was young, and my parents didn't have a lot of money, so I didn't have a telescope or anything. Eventually, I begged them to get me a telescope, and it wasn't much better than binoculars, so I looked at the moon. I loved learning about different planets in the solar system, and then I kind of outgrew that. And then when I was a teenager, this show came on. This is kind of embarrassing. The show called The X-Files, and it had a scientist on it that I fell head over heels in love with. That is the one, the only, Dr. Dana Scully from The X-Files. And man, I just respected her character so much because she was always like, Mulder was crazy. And he's like, it's aliens. And she's like, no, it's science. Even though in the show you clearly saw it was aliens, I still loved her dogged determination to the scientific method. Finally, it would be probably in university. I never thought about being a science teacher. I was actually going to school for something else completely different. And I had a professor that did a whole bunch of chemistry demos. And it was like, wow, this is so interesting. I wasn't really even interested in chemistry in high school, but when I got to university, it was like a switch went on, and I loved the showmanship of that and how engaged the entire class was, and that's probably what changed my final path to become a teacher, a science teacher.
Yeah, some of my friends are in your science class, and they say it's pretty fun. You put a lot of memes in everything. But yes, that is the end of the mailbag. I'm going to close up the mailbag. We're going ecologically friendly with paper bags now. But what about the trees? Whatever. Eventually, we're just going to switch to metal bags. But yeah, that's been the mailbag. Thank you for your questions. I enjoyed, and I bet Mom and Dad enjoyed answering the questions too. They're very fun. It's nice to know that our audience is engaged with us in this way, that they can ask questions and we can answer them. But for now, this has been me, Adam. Bye-bye.
That's the end of this week's show. Thanks for coming back to listen to us for science goodness. Special thanks to our guest, Moya McTeer, who talked to us about space, folklore, and tattoos. Make sure you check out her podcast, Exolore. I've got a link in the description to the show. And I'd like to give a special shout out to our top tier patrons. Without their support, the podcast wouldn't be what it is. So take it away, Chris. Give them some cred.
Catherine Lynch, Judith Morton, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Daniel Fry, Shelby Leggett, Karen Beth St. George, Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Kathy Zerker, Liz Button, and Ben Rathert.
Let's end with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.